This is Americana.
I went over the battlefield carefully, with a view to determining in my own mind how the fight was fought. I arrived at the conclusion then, as I have now, that it was a rout, a panic, till the last man was killed, that there was no line formed. There was no line on the battlefield. You can take a handful of corn and scatter it over the floor and make just such lines. Only where General Custer was found was there any evidence of a stand.
The words you have just heard are from the testimony of Captain F.W. Benteen at the Reno Court of Inquiry. This program is Americana, the 16th in a series of radio essays on the American scene, presented each week by Northwestern University in cooperation with station WMAQ. Tonight, we bring you The Reason Why.
Good evening. I'm Martin Maloney of the School of Speech at Northwestern University. It's interesting sometimes to reflect on how our attitudes toward experience change. It seems to me, for example, that not very many years ago, only a few people were prepared to take an interest in the history and mechanics of warfare. Organized homicide seemed at once remote and improper to us. We were prepared to accept the experiences of the First World War in serious fiction, Dos Passos Three Soldiers, for instance, as long as the author expressed a sort of stern Wilsonian disapproval of the whole business. And we would accept it in popular entertainments. For example, do you remember the various movie sequels to What Price Glory? So long as Victor McLaughlin and Edmund Lowe managed to win the war and the affections of Miss Renee Adore without any casualties on our side. But who at that time would have read Clausewitz or taken a very active interest in the tactics of Gettysburg, Austerlitz, or the Marne? Aside from professional soldiers and historians, not very many, I think. But it appears that by now times have changed. Not, as the Frenchman remarked, we have changed all that, but rather all that has been changed for us, changed by World War, Cold War, Little War, Undeclared War. I don't mean to say that the change is for the better. I only observe that nowadays many of us can follow with understanding an account of human experience in that most tragic of all human activities, war. Here's a case in point. Last summer, an Englishwoman named Cecil Woodham Smith published in this country one of the most fascinating and best-written histories of the season, a book called The Reason Why, an account of the charge of the Light Brigade of Cavalry at Balaclava during the Crimean War. So extraordinary is this story that I think we must tell you a little about it. For although the story is far removed from American history, it has its American counterparts. To begin with, the British and their French and Turkish allies were encamped near Sebastopol in the Crimea. The port through which their supplies and equipment had to come was Balaclava. The battle was fought to protect the road which ran from Balaclava to the British camp. The valley itself is a plain about 3 miles long and 2 miles wide, almost completely enclosed by hills. It runs east and west, and through it runs the Voronzov Road, which was the prize of battle. Lord Raglan, the British commander-in-chief, together with most of his army, held the west end of the valley. The hills to the north were held by Russian infantry and guns. Those to the east, at the far end of the valley, by more Russian infantry and by batteries of heavy guns. The ridges on the south were occupied by Turkish troops under Raglan's command, who served heavy batteries of naval guns. Unfortunately, the Russians attacked these Turkish batteries and took some of them, so that the plain of Balaclava was boxed in on three sides by the Russian arms. Lord Raglan, from his position overlooking the plain, could see that these gun positions must be retaken. So he issued his famous fourth order of the battle, which read,
Lord Raglan wishes the cavalry to advance rapidly to the front. Follow the enemy and try to prevent the enemy carrying away the guns. Troop horse artillery may accompany. French cavalry is on your left. Immediate.
This order was handed to an aide-de-camp, Captain Edward Nolan, to deliver to Lord Lucan, who commanded the cavalry brigades, both light and heavy, and who waited in the plain below. Captain Nolan was a man who believed in the invincibility of light cavalry and in the principle that wars are fought chiefly to provide death and glory for men like himself. He also despised the Earl of Lucan as a cautious, fussy, rather ridiculous commander.
Lord Lucan read the order carefully, with the fussy deliberateness which maddened his staff, while Nolan quivered with impatience at his side. In his own account of these fatal moments, Lucan says that he hesitated and urged the uselessness of such an attack and the dangers attending it. But Nolan, almost insane with impatience, cut him short and in a most authoritative tone repeated the message he had been given on the heights. Lord Raglan's orders are that the cavalry are to attack immediately. For such a tone to be used by an aide-de-camp to a lieutenant general was unheard of. Moreover, Lord Lucan was perfectly aware that Nolan detested him and habitually abused him. It would have been asking a very great deal of any man to keep his temper in such circumstances, and Lord Lucan's temper was violent. He turned angrily on Nolan. Attack! Attack what? What gun, sir? The crucial moment had arrived. Nolan threw back his head and, in a most disrespectful and significant manner, flung out his arm and, with a furious gesture, pointed not to the Causeway Heights and the redoubts with the captured British guns, but to the end of the North Valley, where the Russian cavalry, routed by the heavy brigade, were now established with their guns in front of them. He said, "There, my lord, there is your enemy. There are your guns." And with those words and that gesture, the doom of the light brigade was sealed.
Nolan himself requested and received permission to ride in the charge. He died, incidentally, about halfway down the valley. As for Lord Lucan, he in his turn approached the Earl of Cardigan, who commanded the light brigade. Cardigan, whom Lord Lucan hated with a splenetic passion.
Holding the order in his hand, Lord Lucan informed Lord Cardigan of the contents and ordered him to advance down the North Valley with the light brigade, while he himself followed in support with the heavy brigade. Lord Cardigan now took an astonishing step. Much as he hated the man standing before him, rigid as were his ideas of military etiquette, he remonstrated with his superior officer. Bringing down his sword in salute, he said, "Certainly, sir, but allow me to point out to you that the Russians have a battery in the valley on our front, and batteries and riflemen on both sides." Lord Lucan once more shrugged his shoulders and said, I know it, but Lord Raglan will have it. We have no choice but to obey." Lord Cardigan saluted once more, wheeled his horse, rode over to his second-in-command, Lord George Paget, remarking aloud to himself as he did so, "Well, here goes the last of the Brutinels." Lord Cardigan placed himself quite alone, about 2 lengths in front of his staff and 5 lengths in advance of his front line. He now drew his sword. He raised it. A single trumpet sounded, and without any signs of excitement and in a quiet voice, he gave them orders. "The brigade will advance. Walk, march, trot." And the 3 lines of the light brigade began to move, followed after a few minutes' interval by the heavy brigade led by Lord Lucan. As the brigade moved, a sudden silence fell over the battlefield. By chance, for a moment, gun and rifle fire ceased, and the watchers on the field felt the pause was sinister. More than half a century afterwards, old men recalled that as the light brigade moved to its doom, a strange hush fell, and it became so quiet that the jingle of bits and accoutrements could be clearly heard. Before the light brigade had charged, the hush came to an end. The Russian guns crashed out, and great clouds of smoke rose at the end of the valley. And now the watchers in the heights saw that the lines of horsemen, like toys down in the plain, were expanding and contracting with strange mechanical precision. Death was coming fast, and the light brigade was meeting death in perfect order. As a man or horse dropped, the riders on each side of him opened out. As soon as they had ridden clear, the ranks closed again. Orderly, orderly as if on the parade ground, the light brigade rode on. But its numbers grew every moment smaller and smaller as they moved down the valley. Those in the heights who could understand what that regular mechanical movement meant in terms of discipline and courage were intolerably moved. And one old soldier burst into tears. It was at this moment that Bosquet, the French general, observed.
It is magnificent, but it is not warfare.
There's little need to tell you how the charge resulted. The cavalry did not break. The handful of men left at the end of that 3-mile ride, one of them was Cardigan, crashed through the gun positions and eventually drifted back to their own end of the valley. They had attacked the wrong positions, and nothing much was gained by their incredible sacrifice, at least as far as the battle was concerned. But what an amazing patchwork of folly led to that magnificent and terrible exploit of the Light Brigade. The spectacle of iron discipline and superb courage gone wrong, twisted into the paths of destruction by the handsome, wealthy, aristocratic, brave, and stupid man who commanded that day. All this you can read in Miss Woodham Smith's book, The Reason Why. And I'm sure that you'll find the reading, as I did, an engrossing experience. You may remember that a few weeks ago we had occasion to mention on one of these Americana broadcasts the Lakeside Classics edition of General George A. Custer's My Life on the Plains. Of course, what everyone knows about Custer is his famous last stand at the Little Bighorn. And I began to wonder whether we might not find in that remarkable event some sort of American parallel to the charge at Balaclava. Certainly, Custer is still a controversial figure, and the action at the Little Bighorn a controversial event. Books and articles still come out with surprising frequency, both on the man and the battle. There is, for example, Colonel William Graham, a retired Army officer who has himself published a small library of books on Custer, including The Custer Myth, The Story of the Little Bighorn, and The Reno Court of Inquiry. What with all the research that's been done on Custer, I should hate to think that we will be able to clear up the mysteries of his death in these few minutes of discussion. Nevertheless, unsolved problems have their fascination, especially when the solution's of no practical moment. And if we leave the annihilation of Custer's command as puzzling an affair as we found it, no great harm will be done. The time is the time of the climax of the Indian Wars, that prolonged and tragic struggle which makes so dark a stain in the pattern of American history. From the time of the earliest settlements on the American continent, this warfare had been carried on, and it ended no earlier than the very turn of this century. The details we all know by heart, if I may use so curious a term to describe this process of spiritual osmosis.
There was on the one hand the nightmare figure of the painted warrior, yelling his war cry, the scalping knife, the smoldering settler's cabin after a night raid, the Sioux ponies circling the embattled wagon train. And on the other hand, the broken treaties, the treacheries private and public, the dreadful death marches of whole tribes forced from their ancestral lands into distant reservations, the savagery of the frontiersmen, even the calculated extermination of the whole villages and tribes. The Comanches, one author has written, roamed all over Texas, killing any white people they saw. And on the other hand, the broken treaties, the treacheries private and public, the dreadful death marches of whole tribes forced from their ancestral lands into distant reservations, the savagery of the frontiersmen, even the calculated extermination of the whole villages and tribes. The Comanches, one author has written, roamed all over Texas, killing any white people they saw. It got so bad that General McKenzie was sent out with a large body of soldiers to end the raids. He told his boys, kill all the nits and you'll have no lice. The soldiers knew what he meant. So when they had cornered the Comanches here, they mowed down women and children with the men. 1,500 in all, it is said.
This long and terrible story of brutality is an inescapable part of our heritage. We sometimes concern ourselves with the violence which seems to smolder beneath so much of American life. And if we do, we have not far to go to seek at least one of its sources. In the days after the Civil War, this struggle had moved to the Great Plains, to the Dakotas and Kansas and Montana and Wyoming and the Oklahoma Territory. There came railroads and settlements and the great buffalo hunts by white hunters, and the tribes of the plains fell back before them, fell back slowly and resentfully, striking heavily from time to time at the soldiers and machines and settlers who pushed them from their hunting grounds. Of the tribes of plains Indians, the Sioux were perhaps most typical. A proud, nomadic people whose life turned on hunting, they developed a society and a code curiously like that of medieval chivalry. As Ruth Underhill writes in Red Man's America,
the medieval knights saddled themselves with all sorts of rules about whom they might fight and how it must be done. Rules which would have been impractical in serious warfare. The Plains Indians did something similar. Each tribe set up a series of war exploits, entitling a man to special insignia. The first quite usually was striking or just touching a live enemy in the course of battle. This, of course, was more dangerous than shooting him with a bow from a distance, and some men went into battle armed only with a special stick for the purpose. Another was touching a dead enemy, surrounded, of course, by fighting comrades defending his scalp. A third was cutting loose a trained horse from within the enemy's camp, with the danger of attackers rushing out from every lodge. After these came killing and scalping, which, after all, could be done with little harm to the perpetrator.
Of course, when white settlers began to move onto the plains, with the blue uniformed cavalry trained in the Civil War to support them, all this changed. Warfare to the Plains Indians was no longer a ritual. It was a means of survival. Great chiefs like Sitting Bull, young warriors like Crazy Horse became fanatics, and understandably so, in their desperate urge to destroy their enemies or be destroyed themselves. And the huntsmen of the Sioux and the other Plains tribes very quickly converted themselves into some of the finest irregular cavalry in the world. In the spring of 1876, the Sioux gathered and encamped near the Little Bighorn. It was a great council, the purpose apparently to decide whether the tribe should take to the warpath or sue for peace. Custer, when he ordered Major Reno a few days later to cross the Little Bighorn and attack, made the decision for the council. And Custer was not the only one who had occasion to regret the decision. The battle at the Little Bighorn is in some respects a mysterious event to this day. Mysterious chiefly because Custer seems to have made a grievous series of blunders and then to have died without ever having a chance to explain what he thought he was doing. The United States Army was not eager after the fact to discuss the Little Bighorn in public. After all, one of the crack cavalry regiments was the 7th, and Custer had been a national hero, and the hero and his regiment had been decisively beaten and nearly annihilated in an action which was decided within the first hour of fighting. But Frederick Whitaker, a civilian and friend of Custer, refused to let the matter rest. At any cost, he felt, Custer's name must be cleared, even though other names were somewhat muddied in the process. The most suitable scapegoat for the purpose was Major Marcus A. Reno, Custer's second in command. Whitaker finally exerted sufficient political pressure so that in 1879, a military court of inquiry was called to meet in Chicago. Purpose? To investigate the behavior of Major Reno at the Little Bighorn. It's from the official record of proceedings of the Reno Court of Inquiry, as edited and published by Colonel William A. Graham, that we take our story.
The regiment left the camp at the mouth of the Rosebud River. After passing in review before the department commander, under command of Brevet Major General G.A. Custer, Lieutenant Colonel, in the afternoon of the 22nd of June, and marched up the Rosebud 12 miles and encamped.
That was Major Reno, making his report after the battle, July 5th, 1876. As he says, they marched on the afternoon of the 22nd of June and continued the march toward the Little Bighorn on the 23rd. There were, of course, scouts with the command, and Custer had sent them on ahead. But when they reported on the morning of the 24th, he refused to believe them. Captain Benteen later testified,
General Custer told us that he had just come down from the mountain. He had been told by the scouts that they could see a village, ponies and teepees and smoke. General Custer gave it to us as his belief that they were mistaken, that there were no Indians there, that he had looked through his glasses and could not see any and didn't think that there were any there.
This is, to me, one of the puzzles of the Little Bighorn. General Custer has been described by one of his biographers as a glory hunter, and others have spoken of him even less gently. Perhaps his great courage, his almost adolescent love of fighting, blinded him. At any rate, he at first refused to believe that there was an Indian encampment before him, and apparently he never did realize until it was too late just how many Indians were opposed to him. And how many Indians were there? No one knows for certain. Colonel Graham speculates on this point.
We know that the Indian village comprised at least 6 tribal circles, 5 of which pertained to segments of the Sioux Nation. The 6th was composed of Northern Cheyennes. Sioux tribes represented were the Uncapapas, Blackfeet, Sans Arc, Minneconjou, and Ogallala. Augmenting the 6 circles, the village contained also a smattering of young men of other tribes, for the most part Brule, Yankatones, Santee, some stray Arapahoes, and probably a few Gros Ventre. The total population of the village, 11,700. Warriors, 3,655 plus.
At any rate, as the command approached the Little Bighorn, Custer made the decision which sealed his fate. He divided his command into 3 columns as they approached the river. The first column, under Benteen, was to move down the river to the left. The second, under Major Reno, was to cross the river and attack the enemy encampments. Major Reno later testified,
"I moved forward to the head of the column, and shortly after Lieutenant Cook came to me and said, 'General Custer directs you to take as rapid a gait as you think prudent and charge the village afterward. You'll be supported by the whole outfit.' I took a trot and proceeded to carry out my orders. I crossed the creek, formed my battalion with 2 companies in line and 1 in reserve. I'd been a good deal in the Indian country, and I was convinced that they were there in overwhelming numbers. I sent word back 2 times. First by a man named McGillergy, my striker, to say that the Indians were in front of me in strong force. Receiving no instructions, I sent a 2nd man, Mitchell, a cook. I still heard nothing to guide my movement, and so I proceeded down the valley to carry out my orders. We were then at a gallop. I was about 40 paces in advance. I could see a disposition on the part of the Indians to lead us on, and that idea was confirmed when, upon advancing a little bit further, I could see them coming out of a ravine in which they had hidden. I saw I couldn't successfully make an offensive charge because their numbers had thrown me on the defensive."
And on the defensive, Major Reno stayed. He stopped his attack, ordered his men to dismount and fight on foot, using a stand of timber nearby as cover. This they did. And after a while, Major Reno, finding himself on low ground and apt to be surrounded, retreated back across the Little Bighorn and took up a position on a hill. Here he was joined by Captain Benteen and his column, who'd carried out his orders and returned. And meantime, what of Custer and his column? It appears that having ordered Reno to attack, he didn't wait to observe the outcome, but instead turned his 5 companies to the right and made off up the river, apparently intending to take the Indians in the flank. Reno's messages he must have ignored. He didn't get far. Again, no one can say precisely what happened, but evidently he was ambushed, never got his troops into fighting formation, and died almost without making any stand whatever. Captain Benteen, a day or so later, took a trip to the scene of Custer's death. He reported,
"I went over the battlefield carefully with a view to determining in my own mind how the fight was fought. I arrived at the conclusion then, as I have now, that it was a rout, a panic, till the last man was killed. That there was no line formed. There was no line on the battlefield. You can take a handful of corn and scatter it over the floor and make just such lines. Only where General Custer was found were there any evidence of a stand."
Of the destruction of Custer's command, Major Reno and Captain Benteen knew nothing at the time. They were having their own troubles, a series of heavy attacks mounted by hundreds and perhaps thousands of Indian warriors. Indeed, it appears that the 7th Cavalry came out of the engagement as well as it did, partially because their Indian opponents were exhilarated over the defeat of Custer, and partially because the destruction of Reno's command had proved to be rather costly. At any rate, the attacks dwindled down.
About 2 p.m., the grass in the bottom was set on fire and followed up by Indians who encouraged its burning. It was evident to me it was done for a purpose. The creation of a dense cloud of smoke behind which they were packing and preparing to move their village. It was between 6 and 7 p.m. that the village came out from behind the dense clouds of smoke and dust, and we had a close and good view of them as they filed away in the direction of the Bighorn Mountains, moving in almost perfect military order. The length of the column was fully equal to that of a large division of the cavalry corps of the Army of the Potomac, as I have seen in its march.
And that was approximately what happened at the Little Bighorn. It was a tragic event for all concerned in it. Custer, who loved life and glory, died in a peculiarly futile and inglorious way. Reno was exonerated by the Court of Inquiry, but he got into other difficulties a few years later and was dismissed from the service. For the Sioux and their allies, it was a glorious but hopeless victory. Their chiefs fell captive or were killed, and despite their courage, they never had a chance to win any more than an occasional battle of their war. Also, saddest of all, the destruction of Custer and his troops was generally taken as additional proof of Indian treachery and savagery, and so delayed still further any rational or humane consideration of the Indian problem which actually plagues the nation to this very day. All in all, the battle on the Little Bighorn was a notable scene in a long tragedy of errors on which we may hope that the curtain has now been finally lowered. It's one of the consolations of history that the blunders and the errors we experience in reading it all seem, at least, to be safely buried in the past.
Been listening to Americana, the 16th in a series of radio essays dealing with American history and American living, presented each week by Northwestern University in cooperation with station WMAQ. Americana is written and narrated by Martin Malone. Direction is by Ralph Knowles. Audio engineering by Ed Gulley. Music supervision by Maury Streetmatter. Turntable operation, Bob Petrillo. The quoted materials were read by myself, Bill Grisky. The books discussed on tonight's program were The Reason Why by Cecil Wooden Smith, published by McGraw-Hill, Red Man's America by Ruth M. Underhill, published by the University of Chicago Press, and The Reno Court of Inquiry by Colonel William A. Graham, published by the Stackpole Company. If you wish to receive a list of the books discussed on this program, please send your name and address in a postcard to Americana, care of the School of Speech, Northwestern University, Evanston, Illinois, and a free copy will be sent to you. This is NBC Radio.